Women regularly hold leadership roles in stats departments at universities and in major statistical organizations. But it wasn't so long ago that women had to fight to be included. At one point, women faculty had to climb through the windows of the faculty club at Berkeley to attend meetings there. The stories of the struggles of women to be accepted in the profession aren't always visible, but one scholar is working to ensure those stories aren't forgotten. That's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Amanda Gaulbeck. She's the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs in the College of Public Health at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, where she's also a professor of biostatistics. Gaulbeck's known for her work on health numeracy, demography, and human intervention trials, but she's also known for her work on statistical narrative and for the biography she's written. She's the author of two about the women at the heart of today's episode. In 2025, Gaulbeck published Florence Nightingale David, a passionate probabilist, statistician, historian, and leader, and in 2017, Equivalence, Elizabeth L. Scott at Berkeley. In 2016, Gaulbeck received the Elizabeth L. Scott Award from the Committee of Presidents of Statistical Societies, quote, for her outstanding efforts in enhancing the status of women and minorities, fostering new leadership opportunities for women and men, promoting diversity at all levels, and advocating for a more inclusive, open, and supportive atmosphere in the statistical sciences, end quote. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In 2021, you published an article in Significance about these two women, F.N. David and Elizabeth L. Scott. Can you just explain a little bit, kind of broadly, what drew your attention to their stories?
Well, I was a graduate student at the University of California at Berkeley, and I actually had the wonderful pleasure of meeting both of these people and knowing them. Elizabeth Scott was my advisor for my master's thesis, and F.N. David helped me to get a consulting contract with the Forestry Service.
Well, that's such a great good fortune to have this connection, to meet up with these two kind of stellar people in the field. You've written these two books. I mean, what is your process to kind of explore and get the background and the story down for writing a biography like these?
I think it was different from one book to the other. For the Elizabeth Scott book, I knew that there was a fabulous archival library at Berkeley called the Bancroft Library. And I knew that because I started out as a PhD student in anthropology there, not biostatistics. And I took a course called History of Anthropology, and I was like the only person in the class. And so, I mean, that was a real benefit because when it came time to do my paper, I had an idea of what I wanted to do. And the person was somebody who, a man actually, who I thought deserved more recognition for his work. And it turned out he had spent some time at Berkeley. And so we figured out that there were some articles about him or some papers about him in the Bancroft Library. So my professor of anthropology walked me across campus, took me into the archive, and basically showed me what to do. So when it came time for me to think about doing a book and the one on Elizabeth Scott, I thought, well, there surely will be some materials on her in Bancroft Library because she had spent her entire career at Berkeley. So I looked online, actually. There was an online index, and in the index, it showed that there was a lot of material for Elizabeth Scott. There were like 148 legal size boxes of material, because what had happened is she died in office, if you will. She died while she was still working. And so Bancroft Library knew that she was important, and so they just took all of her stuff and boxed it up and put it in the archive. But the problem for me is that those materials were marked unprocessed, unavailable for use. So, you know, I guess, you know, I could have just stopped there, but I didn't. I thought, well, okay, the boxes exist. You know, maybe I could go through everything. So I contacted the head of the university library told him what I wanted to do. I told him I was an alum. I told him I was going to write a book. And then he referred me to the head of the Bancroft Library. And basically they said yes. So they allowed me to do this because I was an alum and because I was willing to look through all 148 legal size boxes. So that was an interesting experience. You know, I mean, some of it, you know, made me happy. Some of it made me sad because, you know, they had a lot of setbacks in what they were doing. But I was particularly interested in Elizabeth Scott's work, Academic Women, because when I was a graduate student there, I heard a lot of stories about her telling stories about how the women were not allowed to use the world's biggest telescopes. So that was kind of what happened with the Elizabeth Scott project. And the book is pretty thick. In my mind, it's really like two books. There's like a biography part, and then there's a micro history of the academic women's movement. So if you're interested in how women organized and fought for other academic women, that's the place to look. So that was Elizabeth Scott. F.N. David was different because she had spent a lot of time at Berkeley because she was a close associate of Jerzy Neyman's in the Berkeley department. And she had spent the last part of her career at UC Riverside as their founding chair of statistics. But she also had this relationship. She worked as a consultant for many years with the US Forest Service, which was located just outside of Berkeley. And so with her, I thought, well, let me see what's in Bancroft Library, because she had spent years there and she had taught history of probability at Berkeley. And so I thought maybe there'd be something. Well, there were like five boxes. And I had looked through them at some point previously, just out of curiosity before I decided to write the book about her. And they were, I knew there wasn't enough in there to write a book. So, but somehow or other, I thought I'm going to do this anyway, or I'm going to try to do it anyway. So I had to look farther afield. And so I looked, the first obvious place to look was University College London, where she spent most of her career. Well, guess what? Women don't, there are just, you know, aren't a lot of archival materials about women there. And they tend to be buried in men's collections. So the materials that I found about F.N. David were not in an F.N. David collection, like Elizabeth Scott's were in Elizabeth Scott collection. What I found is that they were buried in Egon Pearson's files and Carl Pearson's files and J.B.S. Haldane. And then even that wasn't very much, you know, so I had to look further. And I quickly figured out that she had done all this war work for the World War II effort on bombing strategies. And she had written multiple white papers for the government. And it turns out they had just declassified them. So I was able to get those. That was exciting for me as a biographer. And then, let's see, what else? I found out where she went to grammar school. And there was a person working there who was really interested in the project. And she came up with a bunch of materials from her F.N. David school days. I did some site visits. Like I went to the little village where she was born. And so there's some information about that. I went to visit her gravesite, which is in the UK. She was so British that even though she emigrated to the United States to be chair at Riverside, she had her body. She arranged to have her body sent back to a little town that she had a cottage in the UK. So I don't know that I know I'm missing some things, but that gives you a flavor of it was a lot harder to find stuff about F.N. David than it was to find stuff about Elizabeth Scott.
So we'll just start with F.N. David since we're there. What made her a figure that you wanted to write about?
She had a really big presence at Berkeley, even though she wasn't on the regular faculty. When people would talk about her, it was more like they would say her name with great emphasis, like F.N. David, you know, instead of just F.N. David, you know. So she had a emphasis about her, and she was definitely, you know, well, her name was well known, but what made her who she was not well known. So I can remember one of the projects that I worked on was to get try to get the cops. Cops had two awards, one in the names of women. One was in the name of Elizabeth Scott, and the other one was in the name of F.N. David. And I remember, so I had spent a lot of years in academic administration, and I remember going to a JSM, coming back to the faculty for a while when I started to write the first book, the one about Elizabeth Scott. I remember going to the JSM and looking, and there would be these signs, you know, telling you who the prominent speakers were, and they were all men. And it really surprised me. I don't know why, but it just surprised me. So I thought that there should be some lectures named after women, but there weren't. I mean, 178 years of the JSM had happened, and there were no lectures named after women. So there's kind of a longer story here, but the part that I wanted to tell especially is that I remember sitting across in one of these big rooms at the JSM, maybe listening to the latest F.N. David Award or something. And I remember emailing with a colleague way across the room, and she was saying, well, what did she do that was so important? And I remember writing back, well, she wrote 9 books, you know, which for the time, being a woman, was phenomenal. And so I realized that people didn't know much about her, even though she had this big award named after her. And the same turned out to be true with Elizabeth Scott, you know. So I think one of the things that you know, I hope I have contributed is that people actually know something about these people who are being recognized by our major associations. Their stories are valuable in countless ways, and so I'm glad we were able to get the COPS awards elevated to include the named lectureships.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Amanda Galbeck about F.N. David and Elizabeth L. Scott and their contributions to the field of statistics.
So can you sketch out a little bit about Elizabeth Scott's contributions?
Yeah, she contributed in, like, I would say about 5 major areas. Her PhD was actually in astronomy, and she published in astronomy journals throughout her career. Then she went to work for Naaman in his stat lab during the war and basically turned herself into a statistician. So she has some papers in pure methods. She also did some work in atmospheric science because cloud seeding was happening and it was expensive, but nobody really knew whether it worked or not. You know, the cloud seeders claimed that it did, but the question was, did it really work? And so Naaman and Scott took that up. For many years, they worked on cloud seeding, and they figured out that, you know, it doesn't always increase rainfall. It doesn't always decrease hail. It can do the opposite, and nobody really understands the conditions for this. She worked on studies in ozone depletion and health. So she did some biostatistics work basically toward the end of her career. And then when she was about 50 or so, that's when she started working on women's issues. And that was kind of something she just fell into. When I went over to Berkeley and I interviewed people that she worked with on those projects, they couldn't really remember how they all got started with it, but I was able to figure that out through the records. And basically, there was a lot of unrest in the cities and lots of things being, you know, burned up. And I mean, it was sort of a disaster time. And so the president of the university decided that he thought that the university should get involved in trying to solve these problems. And so what happened was he basically challenged his faculty to, you know, start doing research in this area and to try to find some solutions. Well, one of the people in the systems office, a woman, she thought, well, maybe women leaders should look at this too, and maybe they have something special to contribute. So she collected a bunch of women leaders on campus. There weren't that many at the time, but the ones that were there, brought them together and basically kind of introduced this whole project. But what the women realized, that it wasn't just minorities who were near absent on the campuses, it was also women. And so Elizabeth Scott's story is interesting because she was like such a researcher at heart that she right away contributed the research questions, like, why are there so few women on the faculty? And why are there so few women pursuing graduate studies and earning their PhDs? And then that soon turned into, why are women being paid less when they have the same experience and education? So always a researcher.
So that was part of, in your title of this, the significance piece, it was The Road Less Traveled. So that was part of the pivot that you saw in terms of the work and focus that she had in her career.
Elizabeth Scott's Road Less Traveled, reflecting on this, she had done much of her work with Jerzy Naiman. And if you think about it, she was the astronomer. But when she published with Naiman in astronomy, he was always first author, even though, you know, that some of the work was on stuff that came out of her dissertation. When they did this cloud seeding atmospheric science studies, Naiman was always first author. And so what happened with her Road Less Traveled is that she went and worked on the women's studies, and he was not part of that. So that's what made her stand out. She took that road less traveled. And when you think about it, you know, what she was doing with Naiman was, I mean, he was this big name guy. You know, women were sort of thought to be like homemakers at the time and stuff. And so what she achieved with him was pretty remarkable, but she didn't really have an equal representation in the literature. And so you could easily look back at that literature and say, well, Naiman was the primary contributor. But really what the situation was is that Naiman insisted that everybody that he worked with, that the publications be in alphabetical order by last name, which is a mathematical tradition, but certainly not the one that a lot of us operate within. So that was sort of the Elizabeth Scott Road Less Traveled. The F.N. David Road Less Traveled has a couple of elements to it. I think mainly it's her deciding to emigrate to the United States in order to lead. Because what happened to her is she did everything that was expected of her at University College London. And she worked under Carl Pearson at first, and then Egon Pearson after that. And Egon, if you read his performance evaluations of F.N. David, he was always highly complimentary, you know, not just of her work per se, but how she contributed to the growth and development of the department. So she was helping him with the leadership of the department and growing it. But when it came time for Egon to retire, he made sure that F.N. David did not succeed him. He wrote to the provost and said, she doesn't have the temperament for this job. And, you know, temperament is a pretty nebulous kind of category. But that's what happened to her. And then I was able to find out, you know, way back when at her school, I told you I figured out where she went to school and had a relationship with someone there who sent me materials. F.N. David was head girl at her school for 4 years in a row. So she was like recognized as a leader early on, you know, but it wasn't going to happen for her at University College London, even though JBS Haldane, this big name guy, wrote a letter in support saying, you know, you're not going to find a better person than F.N. David for this job. So she ended up going to University of California, Riverside, and was chair there for 10 years and was one of the few chairs of a research department in the United States who was a woman at that point.
So what were the biggest surprises for you as you did the research for these two biographies?
Oh, that's an interesting question. A lot of it was a surprise because, you know, I had my head down when I was going to school, you know, and I just kind of did what I was supposed to do. And I didn't realize that I was coming up in a period where this change was taking place, you know. So I think for me, relating it to me personally, that was a surprise that I was actually living through the beginnings of the academic women's movement and surely benefiting from it. F.N. David, nobody knew how she became a statistician. And nobody seemed to know why she came to the United States. And I say that because I went back to Berkeley recently it must have been at the end of last year. They had the 70th anniversary of the department. And I met with somebody who wanted to talk to me about F.N. David because he knew her and he knew her work. And and so forth. And he basically didn't know, you know, why she came. And so I think it was sort of a big secret, you know. And I remember when I was in the archive at University College London and I came up with this piece of paper where Egon was writing to the provost, I remember going like, wow, you know. So that was a big surprise for me, you know. And so then I was able to explain, use the book to explain basically what happened to her, you know, and how she came here.
I want to circle back to something from the beginning about yourself, because I feel like people probably also have these questions. You said you started out in cultural or in anthropology. What made you shift from anthropology into statistics?
Yeah, I was always interested in demography. And the person who was going to chair my dissertation was into demography, of course. And he had been solicited by the American Anthropological Association to do a market study of PhDs in anthropology in academe. And, you know, he had a great sense of ethics. I mean, I really, all these years, thought about this, because he called the graduate students together in anthropology and said, well, here are the results. And you have to decide what you want to do. You can stay here a long time and kind of wait this out, because there basically it showed, the study showed that there weren't many jobs. And you can wait this out, or, you know, you can kind of go do something else. And I thought, well, you know, I'm doing demography and I could go over to biostat. There was a guy, a faculty member, who was doing birth and death stochastic process modeling. Okay. So I went over and I talked to him, and he said, yeah, well, how much math have you had? And when I was an undergraduate, I had an anthro major, but I had every math course that I needed for a math major except for one.
Oh, wow. And
yeah. So, so he was like happy to see me, you know, and then he said, well, if we do this, if you get a PhD in biostat, you should get a master's degree in stat along the way, because you'll be a better biostatistician, and you should go talk to Elizabeth Scott. And so that's how I met Elizabeth Scott, and she was happy to have me too. So, yeah.
What a great trajectory. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is as part of your career beyond your biographies, you got involved with health numeracy.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just tell us a little bit about that? That was something I learned about you in doing some of the background for this, but I'm curious if you'd tell a little bit of that tale.
Well, I found out that the Institute of Medicine had put out a report on health literacy and the importance of health literacy. And when I read it, you know, I saw that numeracy was buried in there, you know, and I, being a statistician, I thought that's not good, you know. And so I put together a team of people, and, you know, we thought about it and wrote basically the first definition of health numeracy. And then I ended up teaching a course here in health numeracy for a number of years, which was really enlightening, because I mean, I always thought it was important, but I would get dual degree students with pharmacy saying to me, you know, this course was so important for me, I'm going to practice completely differently now, you know, because the first thing I do is point out to them how loaded their interactions are with patients, how loaded they are with numeracy. And people don't realize that, I think, when they walk into a doctor's office. You know, you have to think that through and pay attention. But there's a lot of numeracy that happens, you know, in those encounters. Yep.
Before we leave, what is health numeracy?
Health numeracy is, you know, basically it's getting the patient and the provider, you know, on the same wavelength to transmit and understand numerical information. And sometimes that in requires, I think, education on the part of the provider. Sometimes it requires tools, you know, like different kinds of ways of using graphs or, you know, visuals, and putting them together at a level that the patient can understand. So it's sort of like you're looking at this interface between provider and patient, and trying to get the communication across this channel.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Amanda.
Well, you're very welcome.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.